Welcome to the Early Bird Book Club podcast of Nashville Public Library. This is Deanna Larson. Today we're speaking to Ira Rosofsky, author of Nasty, Brutish, and Long, Adventures in Old Age and the World of Elder Care, published by Avery. Ira Rosofsky is a psychologist who received his PhD from the University of Chicago, and he has had years of experience serving residents in nursing homes and assisted living facilities. He tells a coming-of-old-age story, and it's a candid, humane, and even humorous look at the world of elder care. It's also a poignant meditation on mortality and the choices we've made as a society about our health care for the elderly.
Hey, Ira, it's Deanna Larson at National Public Library.
Hi, how are you?
I found Nasty, Brutish, and Long so fascinating, disheartening, and heartening all at the same time.
Thank you.
And I think it was such a brave book because I don't know if you did any research before you proposed this to the publisher, but is there any other book like this?
Well, one book that someone told me about, which I've looked at a little bit, is there's a book written by a sociologist about 20 years ago called Living and Dying in Murray Manor, where he was he kind of went undercover, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a book that someone told me about that was written by a Dutch psychiatrist, actually, called Dancing with Mr. D.
Mm.
And people said my book reminds me of that one. He was, it was written that he worked in very personal kind of account of his work in Dutch nursing homes where he had to deal more with the issue of assisted suicide, which is legal in the Netherlands. There's some other books, you know, personal experiences. A book that's not like, but do you know Thomas Lynch who wrote The Undertaking?
Oh, yes, I think I do.
Yeah, I mean, someone flattered me by saying that I did for nursing homes what he did for funeral homes.
You know, they're really not talked about. And I kind of thought about The Loved One a little bit as I was reading through your book.
Yeah.
I felt like there was this little sort of trail of, you know, dark humor and your sort of basic humanity, but you're describing some things that are very, very painful for us to even acknowledge.
Yeah, well, that's the way it is. I mean, I didn't deal with it until I started working in nursing homes, and personally I didn't deal with it until it became an issue, particularly for my father. My mother just died suddenly.
Right.
And my mother-in-law spent a little time in a nursing home trying to shake an infection she received in a hospital, and successfully. And my father-in-law was like my mother. He was fine in the morning and died in the afternoon.
Well, I was just wondering, with your background, I know you said you had taught for a while, but did you specifically go into geriatric psychiatry?
To be honest, no. It was kind of a migration. The story is that I was a bit of a stay-at-home parent for a while in early 90s, mm-hmm. and then, as women say, my children went off to school. This job opportunity presented itself to me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had done some work with geriatric populations as a student, you know, in working in mental health clinics,
mm-hmm.
but to be honest, I was not specifically trained in geriatric care. In fact, it's kind of hard, I've discovered, to get training in geriatric care. Someone told me that I didn't verify this, for psychiatry, there's only one geriatric psychiatry program in the country. I mean, that seemed a bit extreme, but I think a lot of people kind of migrate into it, at least on the clinical end, over a course of a career.
Now, why do you think that is, that there aren't that many programs?
I think maybe 50 years ago, people didn't live that long, and I think that it's probably going to change over time in the future.
Yeah.
I think that might be the simple answer. It's also like maybe not the most attractive field. You know, everyone wants to have, like, Woody Allen as their someone who's going to be there for, you know, that's the fantasy. Someone who's going to be your patient for 25 years and can pay his bill on time. But there's also a lot, you know, some of the special populations, like mental retardation, it's hard to attract people into that field.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the less, let's say, glamorous psychiatric, psychotherapeutic populations.
But then, you know, that brings up an interesting point, which is, where does your sense of gratification come from when you're working with a population that sometimes is having a hard time even communicating with you or being able to kind of communicate in ways that we would be used to outside of a nursing home or a mental health?
Well, for me as a psychologist, I tend to, except for I will evaluate people who are at a low level of functioning, but in terms of continuing in any kind of counseling experience, mm-hmm. they have to have the ability to communicate with me, or else I'm, you know, taking mostly the government's money on false pretenses. I mean, I like to think that if they can remember who I am the next time I show up, then they qualify to be in some kind of counseling situation.
Right. And were they always happy to see you again, or was it sometimes under duress?
A lot of the people are feel isolated from their family. You know, their families might be scattered around the country, or they may not have any relatives alive yet still.
Yeah.
And a lot of those people are happy to talk to me. I mean, they're happy to talk to anybody. I think it varies, just like any population. Mm-hmm. I mean, I tell people that this is all voluntary. There are some people who resist. I don't want to see you. But mm-hmm. there's some people, most people are happy to talk to me. I mean, this is a generation. Most of the people in nursing homes are in their 80s,
mm-hmm.
so these are people for whom finding themselves in the consultation room was not really part of their life. You know, they're from the generation, like, why do I want to see a psychologist? I'm not crazy type of people. There is that prejudice.
Well, did you deal with a lot of grief over the fact that, I mean, let's just say they were cognizant enough of this that, oh my gosh, my life has come to this. A strange man has come into my room and said, would you like to talk? And I have no family or friends around me, and I'm talking to this person because this is really all I've got.
I don't think it's all I've got. I think that many people in nursing, you know, the number one complaint I hear about people in nursing home are able to formulate a complaint mm-hmm. in that sense, or feeling like my life was great until I came here. And it's not really a reflection of the quality of the nursing home.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, as I like to say, if you were locked up in the Waldorf Astoria with room service, mm-hmm. but the door was locked and you couldn't go outside and take a walk, eventually you would feel like, I would rather be in my slummy apartment where I can go walk around my neighborhood. I think the sense of confinement and loss of control and loss of mastery over your life, that's the biggest loss. If you think about people, older people, how difficult it is to give up their driver's license, and then you kind of multiply that by maybe 100 or 1,000,
mm-hmm.
you might get a sense of the disconnection that you find in a nursing home. People who are, you know, who spend maybe 50, 60 years of independent living as adults, and then all of a sudden they're in this kind of uniform situation where, as I put it in my book, you know, we have a stranger for a roommate, a curtain for privacy, and the door is always open. Many people in nursing homes don't need to be in that kind of heavy-duty environment. For many people, I think they can do as well at home or in an assisted living facility, and the nursing homes themselves don't have to look like hospitals. I mean, I don't see the need that they have to have, like, the obvious nursing station, PA systems going off.
Mm-hmm.
The rooms could be designed a little more home-like, and I think that there are movements in that direction. What we say is the gold standard for all human services is to provide them in the least restrictive environment. And so maybe there's kind of an aligning of the stars with dire economic times we're in and more rational planning about, we don't need to spend $60,000 a year to keep someone in a nursing home when $25,000 and $30,000 can actually keep them in an assisted living facility or at home, which may be more appropriate.
You've spent so much time in these facilities, and obviously people who may be listening to this podcast and facing this with their own family, they might say, why are these my only options for my loved one? Why is that?
Well, they aren't their only options. Typically, the way people typically wind up in nursing homes, and I kind of call them accidental tourists, mm-hmm. is that you're kind of bumping along okay in life, and then unfortunately you fall and break your hip, a very typical scenario, or you get, let's say, pneumonia, that's also fairly common, and you wind up in the hospital. A couple of days later, you know, nobody gets to stay in the hospital very long. They say to you, well, you need, Mr. Rozovsky, we've stabilized you, we've done the best we can, the most we can for you, and now you need to go into a rehab facility.
Mm-hmm.
And Medicare will pay for it,
mm-hmm.
but you have to take the first available bed in your community, or else we won't pay for it. After rehab, if you make it home, great. If people can kind of stand anything for a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't, you tend to stay where you are. But there are resources, as I said. There is beginning to be at least pilot funding for assisted living facilities or home care. And I think, you know, my baby boom generation, we're not going to want to be in nursing homes. So we want what we want. We're probably going to put pressure on both because we're going to be so expensive to take care of. Mm-hmm. They're going to be looking at less restrictive, more cost-effective environments. But if people hearing this, you know, there is one good resource that I point to is to go to Medicare.gov, type in nursing home, mm-hmm. and you'll come to a page which will have more than you ever want to know, but including links to local ratings of nursing homes in your community, as well as links to community-based alternatives to nursing home care.
Our Early Bird Book Club, we ask the people who have won a copy of your book to submit questions. And we had a question submitted by a person who won your book. She was wondering why you decided to hospitalize your father before making the hospice decision.
Partly, you know, that was a tough one because my brother and I had an advance directive saying that we would not do heroic procedures. Mm-hmm. But after the doctor examined my father, he said he had a chance to recover. That's the 25 words or less.
Right.
He said it wasn't a great chance, but it was better than zero. And there was a period of time in the 2 or 3 weeks he was in the hospital where he seemed to be rallying, was feeding mm-hmm. himself, and then had another relapse. And, it was at the point in which they said they want to insert a feeding tube that we said, you know, enough already. And, you know, the odd thing is that it's easy for people who have power of attorney to get the feeding tube put in. But then we were told once you put the feeding tube in, it's real, you can't get the feeding tube out because that's like withdrawing care that's, you know, that's already, it's like taking away something that's keeping him alive. In my father's case, since he had severe dementia, he would have probably had to have been heavily sedated and tied down so he wouldn't try to pull the tube out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes these decisions almost make themselves when you're confronted with a situation like that.
And Ira, do you feel like having been through, you know, not with your mom obviously, but with your dad, having been through something so similar to probably the families of the patients that you try to help, did it change your mind about anything or help you in your work to have gone through that with your dad?
I think in subtle ways, the feeling that, you know, just the simple fact that I can't appreciate many of the people I'm working with are experiencing. I'm not saying that I had to have that experience mm-hmm. in order to have the kind of empathy that we therapists would like to have for the people we work with,
mm-hmm.
but it didn't hurt.
Okay, another question from another Early Bird Book Club member was, they were wondering if when you were talking to nursing home residents, how forthcoming they were about their caregivers. Or were the families cooperative? And the reason he asks is because our state legislature is under siege from nursing home operators who say they're being sued out of business.
I'm not sure what you...
Well, I guess he was wondering if they were, like, when you were in the room with them, could they be honest if they were being abused or mistreated or any other kind of...
You mean would they be afraid to be forthcoming?
That's right.
Oddly, I would think that some of the people who are, let's say, not 100%, mm-hmm. they're not going to be inhibited in telling me what. They're not going to be able to say, maybe this isn't a good idea to tell Dr. Rozovsky. But I find for the most part that, particularly when you have a family that, you know, is keeping an eagle eye on things and is there, like, you know, if not every day and every hour, but they're often enough, I think the staff... I don't think there's an issue of being afraid of the staff. And the other thing I can say, I don't know what's going on in Tennessee, but for the most part, you know, regardless of, you know, what you think about these institutions and whether they're organized the right way, mm-hmm. the people who are running them want to do the best they can. Mm-hmm. And they don't want people on their staff who are abusing
right.
residents. And so I don't think that people should be afraid to do that, unless there's some kind of conspiracy going on at a particular nursing home, mm-hmm. which I don't really see happening very much. I think that, you know, one of the things I say was, like, you know, 30, 40 years ago, there were a number of, like, tabloid stories of people, you know, nursing home owners being packed off to jail and snake pit nursing home headline type of things. Then the government in 1987 passed a big law which highly regulated the institutions, requiring them to have services like physical therapy, that there be a dietitian, that there be a recreation program, and that there be a tremendous amount of documentation and state inspection. And I think since then, there's really been an improvement overall. The trend line is in the improving, the positive direction in terms of physical care and neglect. I think that they're too, maybe the pendulum has swung so far that they're so regimented and so institutional. So I'd like to see a little balance where there's more like just plain old nurturance. But I think in terms of like abuse and neglect, the picture has probably improved greatly. It's probably better to, it'd be nicer to have more staff with more face time with residents. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one of the points I write in my book is like sometimes I feel like I'm spending as much time writing and documenting about what I'm doing as I do spend time actually doing it. There was some statistic about the average nursing home resident nationally gets about 2 hours and 20 minutes of face time a day, which means that some people are getting more and some people don't need that much time. But I think if there were more people working in small groups with residents, there would be more behavior, so to speak, going on. You know, the patients would be doing more themselves.
And this this reader also asked, and he was almost afraid to ask you, but he wondered if you believe in euthanasia.
I don't believe in euthanasia. If by that he or she means that someone else decides for you that you know your time is up. This is kind of like a spectrum of thing. You know, like you know, if you ask somebody. Let's say you're 85 years old, chances are that we can keep you alive for a month or two more by doing heroic things, but you're probably going to be painful and uncomfortable that whole time. Or we can do nothing and you'll die peacefully, you know, and comfortably within a few days. Mm-hmm. Most people would say that's perfectly reasonable. It's where you're kind of in the middle. Yeah. You know, where someone maybe would live for a year, but in tremendous pain and discomfort, how heroic do we want to be in those cases? That's why I think it's something where, on the one hand, you don't want physicians or professionals deciding who lives or dies. If someone is completely competent, you would like that person to be able to decide how much care they want to keep them alive, depending on their situation. It gets trickier in the middle. It also gets tricky when someone is not able to make the decision for themselves and family members are being called upon to do it. But as far as euthanasia is concerned, I don't agree with
that. And Ira, I was so curious towards the end of the book when you said about your dad's death, when the nurse says he's gone and you say, dry-eyed, heartless me, I cry mostly for dead animals. What did you actually mean by that? And was it something that you had been through so much, you and your brother, with your dad's situation, that you just felt it was a sort of blessing?
Well, maybe in a way that what you said is well, first of all, I should upbraid myself for trying to make a joke about everything.
But
I think what you just said, Deanna, is something that probably was it. That, like, I think, and this is not true for me, but it's for a lot of people I've worked with, is that there's a set, you know, when you've been giving care to somebody who has been going through a long, protracted, difficult final, you know, year or two of their life, you know, that many people feel guilty for saying it, but they will admit that there's a kind of sense of relief that the burden has been lifted not only from them, but that the suffering of the person that they're caring for is also at an end.
Yeah, and there is that black humor of the ER as well. It seems to be something similar where you just deal with so much death and dying and suffering that, in a way, do you think that's a sort of coping mechanism?
That, too, and the other thing that occurs to me, particularly when you're dealing with people who have Alzheimer's, or which my father actually had what they believe vascular dementia. You know, when you're dealing with somebody who hasn't recognized you for a year, you know, it's you know, they call... Alzheimer's has been called the long goodbye, but people have often, in effect, had said goodbye before that. I mean, I don't want to say that my father had no quality of life near the end. I mean, he was still able to enjoy food, and he liked to sing still, and, you know, but there are some people with dementia who don't even recognize food for food.
Right.
So in the sense of, you know, what kind of life, you know, this person was technically alive for the last year of his life, but was he really alive in the sense that it was the person, you know, who was my father or someone's mother or someone's husband or wife? And I think that considering, you know, I had an easy relative to, you know, if you're 80 years old and you're caring for your 80-year-old spouse and you're not too great, in such great shape yourself, there is often, even though, and some people are more or less willing to admit it than others, a sense of relief that the burden has been lifted.
Yep.
And also that the person who died is no longer suffering either.
Are you still working in this field?
And would
I
am.
And do you plan to continue until you retire or go on to something else?
That's hard to say. I mean, I definitely want to. I mean, I'm 62. This is my debut book, and I a lifelong fantasy to be a writer, and I succeeded. And I wouldn't mind if I would have. I would like to publish more books. So if, like, 10 years from now, when I'm 72, mm-hmm. if I were just writing books, that would I could see that as a happy conclusion.
Huh.
Not a happy conclusion,
Great.
But did you want me to explain the title for those?
Yes, please. Yeah.
Yeah. Thomas Hobbes, a British philosopher. 300 years ago, wrote that, you know, man's life is nasty, brutish, and short. Oh. And so it's kind of like a play on that, that, like, in the 1600s, life expectancy was something around 50. Mm-hmm. And so 300 years later, life expectancy is maybe 30 years longer, but is it any less nasty and brutish? Mm-hmm. And Hobbes, incidentally, he lived to be 91, so he was quite unusual for his day and age. In fact, he was in pretty full command towards the end of his life. Apparently, he published the third English translation of the Odyssey and the Iliad when he was 86. So for Hobbes, life was, it's arguable whether his life was nasty and brutish, but it was long in his case.
That's wonderful. Okay, so if you could wave a magic wand and change three major things about the world in which you find yourself, the world of aging, dying, and death, what would those three things be?
That nursing homes don't look like hospitals. That people, that many of that there are thousands and thousands of people in nursing homes who could be in more home-like environments. And that people do take care of themselves and do all the things that their doctors are telling them in terms of, you know, exercise and good diet, which I don't know. I do exercise. My diet could be better. But that will help. On the other hand, not everybody who takes good care of them, you know, sometimes you get dealt a bad hand of genes. For those people who do wind up in nursing homes, that they do find themselves in more nurturing environments, and that those who are not in nursing homes don't need to be in those heavy-duty situations, are able to find more appropriate accommodations.
Sarah, have you thought about your own death in terms of what you would want, or maybe even your own elder care, and what would you describe as your most perfect scenario for yourself?
Well, you know, it's funny you ask that, because people, if you ask them, how would you like to go, the tendency is, I just want to keel over and be gone. And there was a study where they interviewed a group of oncology nurses who spend all their time dealing with people dying of cancer. And they almost to a woman, I think they were mostly women, said, we want cancer. And the reason being that with today's medication, you know, pain medication, comfort measures, you can be very comfortable, and you have, and if you don't die suddenly, you have a chance to put your affairs in order, to say your goodbyes, mm-hmm. and prepare for an orderly exit, so to speak. Whereas people just keel over and die, often leave a mess behind. So I think I probably, I probably want to have the big theatrical deathbed scene.
Well, Ira, I don't want to take up any more of your time, and I so enjoyed speaking with you.
It was a pleasure talking to you, Deanna, and also to anyone else who might hear this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the book was, definitely very thought-provoking for the whole club, and it was the kind of book that you didn't forget when you put down.
Yeah. Now, if anyone wants to, communicate with me, ask me other questions, I try to answer all my email, and maybe not right away, but my webpage is rozovsky.com, and there's a way to leave a comment there if they would like.
That's absolutely excellent. I'm sure they'll love that. I'm sure there'll be other people who weren't part of the Early Bird Book Club who'll find it on our shelves or find it in the bookstore who would, love to communicate with you, too. So that's fantastic.
Well, thanks for the opportunity to speak to your club and people in Nashville.
Yes, absolutely. Ira, thank you, and I really look forward to what you're going to write next.
Okay, I'll let you know. Probably be a couple of years at this point, but maybe just a year. As soon as I know, I'll let you know.
Okay, thanks again.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.